Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Selling your car to Carvana is as easy as...
As easy as pie?
Sure. All you have to do is enter your license plate or VIN.
As easy as a stroll in the park.
Okay, then just answer a few questions and you'll get a real offer in seconds.
As easy as singing!
Why not? Schedule a pickup or drop-off and Carvana will pay you that amount right on the spot.
As easy as playing guitar.
Actually, I find that kind of difficult. But selling your car to Carvana is as easy as...
Can be.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to get an instant offer today.
I've always been very good at is creating my own little world. And I did that from early childhood. It's like, you know, the guitar riff, now, in No Memory. It's quite reminiscent of, say, like Stone Satisfaction or, you know, a T-Rex riff or something. And the Chelsea Hotel was like fabulously dumpy in those days. It hadn't been refurbed and that's how we wanted it. You know, there's some guy in the next room practicing saxophone and because he was living there, the pillows stank. Rob actually had to have his room fumigated because he woke up the next morning with orange juice was full of cockroaches. It was like a family hotel. And they always used to make me show my passport when we came in. I don't know if they thought I was a woman of ill repute or something. And then I got really sweaty and the catsuit became kind of like clingy and sticky. And then the sound was absolutely diabolical. And they bloody well did advertise it. And so all the record companies turned up. They called it manic depressive in those days, but I guess these days they'd probably say bipolar. And he was suicidal very frequently. Throughout my whole career, I've always somehow managed to maintain that drive, even though I've fallen quite badly at certain points.
Maggie K. de Mont, welcome. It's fantastic to see you because I know that you have this reputation of being a very, very positive, warm, kind person.
Carry on.
So you've got something to live up to here for the next hour.
Okay. Oh my God, that's really nice.
And it's really nice, you know, like I had a bit of a bad night and I'm thinking,
oh, God,
we've got to do an interview, but I'm going to enjoy this and I'm going to feel bad. So I hope you
wow.
do too. But I want to take you back, first of all, to your childhood and ask you about the family, your family that you were brought up in. What sort of music they heard and whether they were a creative family in any way?
Do you know, first of all, I think I was really, really lucky that I had a very happy childhood. And do you know what? Sometimes I think back to my very first memory and I just remember I was sitting in a high chair that was blue. I remember the tray was actually blue. And I just remember shafts of sunlight coming through into the kitchen where I was. And I felt happy. I just felt happy, which was really what an amazing thing to have that as your sort of first memory. Yeah, I had a happy childhood. I grew up in Handsworth Wood in Birmingham before we moved to Holborn. My parents were very much into music. My mother particularly, she had a really big sort of, you know, choice of stuff she listened to, including Edith Piaf, Percy Sledge, Iron Butterfly, Kraftwerk. I mean, you name it. And my dad was just a huge Sinatra fan. My mother danced. She danced a lot and she was very glam. And my father, bless him, he liked to try and dance and tap his fingers. But I think actually that he didn't have a very good sense of rhythm. I think he was also a bit tone deaf. his dream was always, bless him, around the Scarlet Fantastic period, he said he wanted to do a duet with me. Bless him. It was a bit bonkers. But it never happened. He'd have had to have had a lot of singing lessons. But I don't actually think you can, if someone's a bit tone deaf, I don't think you can actually teach them to sing. But he loved his music. You know, he was such a Sinatra fan. I think I know every single word to Strangers in the Night. So, yeah. So it was a good childhood. Starting off in Handsworth Wood, I had a brother. You know, we made mud pies and put flower petals on them. I used to save worms. And we had little sales in our shed, you know, sell off old teddy bears and things. It's quite fun.
When did you sort of exhibit a talent for singing and performing?
Oh, my goodness. One of my very first performances, I was in Western Supermare with my little friend Tina Peters, who was about half my height. I think we were 11. And we decided to enter the talent competition at the big, whatever it would have been, you know, one of those great big sort of theatre places. And so we practiced and practiced. I think it was her aunt's house we were staying at. We practiced Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and Green Sleeves. So we were very nervous and we went up anyway. And so there was a pianist on the stage and he said, have you got your music with you? We just went, no. Anyway, we stood. I'm sure we were absolutely diabolical. We did get a consolation prize. We got some chocolates, but I was doing things at school before that. I think like the first play I was in, it was a musical play and it was in my infant school. And I played a raindrop, which is very sweet. I wore little wellies and a plastic mac and I had an umbrella. So.
Were your parents always supportive of you going into that direction? Because you went to drama school when you were a teenager, didn't you? So I just wondered how supportive they were, because if I think of my parents, they were very working class in the effect that you've got to do something that earns a living, you know, don't go into something creative.
Do you know what? Yeah, I mean, that generally is the thing, isn't it? But I guess I was let off the hook, actually. They were very kind of tied up with their own lives. They were very busy people. And they were both like hugely supportive of everything I decided to do or not do. I mean, I went to uni after sort of traveling around and stuff. And, you know, I did my A-levels early and school was a nightmare for me, but that's another story. But I met Rick, who was in Swansway. Well, he was in the first band with me as well, Playthings, before Swansway. And then we were in Scarlet Fantastic together. We met at uni and I left uni. I didn't stay and do the course. And, you know, a lot of parents would probably be annoyed about that kind of thing. My parents didn't mind at all. Absolutely fine. And my mother, bless her, has been really encouraging throughout my whole life, you know, and if I've needed a loan at any point, she's helped me out as well, which is great. I mean, I feel very privileged and very lucky and always believed in me. They never made me feel bad for, you know, not achieving what maybe some people think is thought of as success. I mean, in my humble opinion, I do what I do because I enjoy doing it and I've had some success along the way. And you know, there's still people out there that like what I do and everything. So there's never been any negativity from my mum. And my dad, as I say, was always very supportive. He ended up living in Cape Town, South Africa. And when the Scarlet Fantastic stuff was out, he used to go around the radio stations trying to plug me. Bless him. He's not alive anymore. He died quite young. Bless him. And he actually died wearing a Scarlet Fantastic T-shirt, which is quite sweet, isn't it?
Oh, God, yeah. That's actually very sweet.
I know.
You went to the Birmingham Youth Theatre, so I'll just take you back.
Oh my God,
before
yeah,
university. Did yeah. you have a teacher or a mentor there that actually really passed on information that you have held with you for your life?
I have to say, not at the Birmingham Youth Theatre, but at my primary school, there was this brilliant woman called Miss Beach. And then there was the other guy, Mr. Marshall. He was this great big fellow. And she was this petite woman. And they were so into like music, poetry, drama. I was in my element at primary school in Harborne, Birmingham. I absolutely loved it. That just brought everything. And I was encouraged. You know, and every time I wrote a poem, the headmaster would come in and they'd take my poem, they'd read it out in class, you know, made me feel good about what I did. Unfortunately, the secondary school didn't work like that at all. It was just putting people in boxes and trying to get them to do what they thought you should do, you know, blah, blah, hated that. Regarding the Birmingham Youth Theatre, I didn't actually last too long in that. I got thrown out for talking too much, not paying attention, you know, going out, having a fag. I was just a naughty girl, really.
But, okay, you went to university and that's where you met Rick P. Jones.
Yeah, yeah.
What was your first impression of him? Was it just because you know, fancied him, he was good looking, or was it his talent? What was it about him that you were really attracted?
He was actually very fanciful. And even though I'd had a lot of things going on with blokes, you know, boys, guys, whatever, I think Rick was the first person that I actually really fell in love with. And I think he was my first soulmate. And also, he played in a band. He had a band called the Stay at Homes. And I kind of was really impressed with that because I think I wanted to get involved, you know, somehow in bands and do stuff. And so I think my first sort of rock band experience was standing on the stage with Mary Ann, who is also he was a bass player, it was his girlfriend. So the pair of us stood there in our leopard skin, and you know, God knows what the singing was like. But we did backing vocals for the Stay at Home. So, having said that, way before, I'd say when I was about 14, one of my closest friends, one of my best mates, Shirley, she's still a very close friend. We were at school together. We wrote a song together, very much based and influenced by Rock Follies. We called it Gloriana. So yeah,
How did it go?
It's the lyrics. I seem to remember Mrs. Moffat's done a bunk. The barb shape made her a punk. She flies higher, cooler, higher in an automatic spin dryer. And I can't remember how the tune goes. If Shirley was here, she'd bang it out on the piano, because that's what we do when we get together. Shirley gets on the piano and I sing, and we have a right old laugh.
So whose idea was it to actually then leave university? Was it Rick leaving and you followed, or was it a mutual decision?
Well, the thing was, he was 2 years older than me, see, so. And also, no offence to the people that I was at uni with, because a lot of them are still friends, even though I wasn't there for that long. I had lived quite a life beforehand, and I was having such a great time in Birmingham, partying, you know, going to the Rum Runner, just enjoying a great time. I found it just wasn't rocking my boat at university. It wasn't stimulating me. I was quite bored. I wanted to go back to Birmingham. And actually, because I was in Kent, Canterbury, and actually Rick, as I say, he was 2 years older than me. He stayed on and finished his degree. I moved back to Birmingham, and then he came back to Birmingham and lived with me. And then we just lived together for like 10 years. Amazing. Well, not in my house, but, you know, we got our own little cottage. Actually, it was like £5 a week. It was brilliant.
So tell me about Birmingham at that period, because there was a lot of music coming out of Birmingham, and it was a sort of a centre during the late 70s, early 80s, wasn't it?
It was amazing. And actually, on that, yeah, our first band, Playthings, we were on a TV show called Look Here, and Toya and Chris Phipps were presenting. We were on that. Duran Duran had said that we were the other best band in Birmingham apart from them. We knew Duran Duran quite well, because, you know, everyone just hung out together, and we supported them. I think it might have been their first tour. There was a lot going on. And actually, my brother, bless him, was around at that time. He was a photographer, and he just took photos of everything and everyone, the club scene, fashion, music, bands, and I've just signed a publishing contract to release 3 editions of a book called Duran Duran on Sen. So it's not just all the pics he took of Duran, because he did sessions with them when they were recording their first single, Planet Earth. But it's also like the life that was going on in the Rum Runner. You know, we've got fashion designers like Carl and Belt. I mean, Boy George was around. There was the Ska scene. There was Dexys. There was UB40. There was Steel Pulse. Everyone, and of course, like all of the sort of Red Wedge type bands, you know, like Au Pairs, and you know, there's so much going on. I remember Roland Gift used to live in my road at one point. Used to get a bus, see him on the bus. Everyone was really friendly. I like Birmingham, I still do. Very down to earth place. So it was just a really happening, inspiring sort of cultural melting pot of talent, really. So I loved it. It was inspiring.
Well, the bands you mentioned are so diverse in their music. That's what is really fascinating. Yeah. About this. Was it something where you feel you can look back and say, oh yeah, I really gleaned bits and pieces back then from different people?
Oh, absolutely, 100%. I mean, the very first band I think we had before Playthings, funnily enough, someone just sent a picture to me, and we ended up, we were called The Cats, and the drummer sort of did like ska reggae rhythms. And we did a track on an album, I think it was called Live at the Barrel Organ, and it was organised by Brumbeat, who were the sort of music magazine at the time. And, you know, it's interesting, there were like over 100 people in that photograph, and there were three girls. It was myself, Carol Decker from Tupow, and a girl called Jenny from the Mood Elevators. And you look at that and you think, my God, you know, that's not good. Three girls amongst like over 100 guys, and strange, but that was, as I say, I'll probably share it on my social media at some point, because it was a picture taken from way back, I think it was about 1980, and it was and then, you know, the Stay at Homes, Rick's band, were a punk band. Playthings, we were kind of indie, sort of gothy, punky, pop. And then Swan's Way was like something completely different, meeting Rob Shaw, who, you know, we all ditched what we'd been doing before and brought a completely set of different influences to the music that we created as Swan's Way.
Can you tell me, though, this, because Swan's Way, with the three of you, there's you, Rick, and there's Robert Shaw. And was there a conscious decision with Robert Shaw to make a band, or was there a decision only once you'd met him that you just thought, okay, we've got something here, we can work together? How did that come about?
I think the second thing you said, actually, which was, I can't remember why we met Rob, you know, because it is a long time ago, actually. I mean, oh my God, it's what, 40 years or something? I'm grateful I'm still alive, actually, because a lot of people aren't. So, you know, every day, thank you. So we met Rob, and I can't remember what the purpose of the meeting was originally, or whether we just sort of stumbled across each other, but we bonded, the three of us really bonded. And I think, you know, you do things sort of instinctively, intuitively, well, I do. And we decided we wanted to do something together, but we weren't exactly sure what or how. So we thought, first of all, we'll ditch the instruments that we're used to playing, and we'll all do something we've never done before. So it's like,
I mean, it's a nuts idea.
I know, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's mad. Who would have thought it would have ever worked? But I mean, that's, you know, hey ho. We obviously had some weird insight into why it might work. But so it's like, Maggie, you play drums. And I'm like, oh, all right then. Rick, you play double bass. Okay. Rick's like a guitarist. And Rob, bless him, who was an amazing singer, still is, and a great lyricist. So that's how, that was the bones of the band, a three-piece with me doing the rhythm, Rick on the double bass, and Rob singing. And that the song Soul Train was one of the very first songs that we wrote. And it was just basically written, you know, drums, double bass, and vocals. I mean, later on, Rob did bring in a saxophone that he couldn't play, but he made some interesting noises on it. And he did play a bit of acoustic guitar later on as well, so.
But you hooked up somehow with Simon M. Woods, didn't you?
Oh, my God, Simon Woods, yeah.
Tell me about him then.
Okay, I'll keep it sweet. We were all living in, at that point, in Balsall Heath, in... this is where all of the bands and sort of musicians and fashion people were living, in like charity housing flats. Sounds a bit weird. It was a company, churches and district housing. We all got really great flats. So me and Rick were in this little tiny flat, with two double basses. It's a bit of a squash. And next door, it turned out, Simon Woods was living with his family. And we used to babysit for Simon, me and Rick. And Rick would be ear rolling because we knew that he had been UB40's manager. So Rick was ear rolling him. Oh, I forgot to mention, of course, there was UB40 around as well. Yeah. I was actually in a little film with them called Dance with the Devil that you can find on YouTube. I was looking at it the other day. It's sweet. So Brian Travis directed it, bless him. Okay, so Rick was talking to Simon, and we used to rehearse in our bedroom there as well, tiny flat. And Rick said to Simon, why don't you come over and hear us rehearse? And so Simon did. And Simon said, I want to manage you. So, and it kind of, because he'd got the contacts, which is great. I mean, we had talent, you know, we couldn't have got a deal if we'd not got something going. But we got signed a publishing deal. I think it was with CBS at the time, although they all keep changing. It turned into Sony, but I think it was CBS at the time. So we signed a publishing deal with them. And actually, I think that was after we'd recorded. I think Simon paid for us to go and record our very first single, which was called Theme from the Balcony. And we recorded it in Jacob's Studios, which was a residential studio. I got fond memories of that, actually. I think that was that 82? It might have been. But again, we were trying to be our normal radical selves, and we decided we had to record this single with absolutely no EQ on it. So that's sort of, the engineer was a bit stumped when we said, no, we don't want any EQ, no EQ. So I think everything was like turned to naught, and we just had to record it as it was. So sort of organic, natural. Actually, it doesn't sound too bad. And that's where Rob is playing a do, 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 do on the saxophone. It's called Theme from the Balcony. Yes, yeah, sweet memories, actually.
When Theme from the Balcony was released, and it wasn't a hit. And I just wondered at that point, because when you're tracing your dream, and I know this very well as well, you know, you trace your dream, you get the knocks, and it can be quite difficult. Can you remember back how you felt at that point, and how you got the drive really to keep pushing?
You know, that's a really interesting point about having the drive. Throughout my whole career, I've always somehow managed to maintain that drive, even though I've fallen quite badly at certain points. And if you like, I can tell you about one that was just a dreadful thing that happened. But anyway, do you know, I think we were just so excited. We were so young. I don't think we thought we'd failed. I think, you know, we were just like kids, and this was happening to us. You know, someone had paid for us to go in like a really posh studio and do some recording, and then it got played on the radio. And to us, that was absolute success. And we were, you know, there was a buzz about us in Birmingham. It was all good. We were buzzing. We didn't feel like we'd failed at all. I mean, for us just to have a record out was, you know, that was amazing. We hadn't I don't think we expected it to be a hit. I can't remember who played it. Someone, would it have been Peter Powell or Simon, somebody or other? But I mean, we had quite a lot of credibility in our own hometown, and we had a certain look and a style, and people were picking up on us because we were doing quite a lot of live gigs, and the feedback was all really positive. So I don't think we felt we'd failed at all. We felt we were on a mission, at the beginning of a mission. So,
oh, fantastic. Although, talking about drive, I find this really fascinating, because I believe that everyone who's successful, their drive is based in some sort of childhood wound. It's based in the past, in their early days. You know, you can sort of base
interesting
it. If you look at Tina Turner, it's often it's about her childhood and mm-hmm. the things that happened to her when she was mm-hmm. really young. If you look mm-hmm. at Madonna, the need mm-hmm. for attention comes from when her mother died.
Oh yeah, I can relate to that. I mean, I didn't go into great big detail about my dad, but he was, they called it manic depressive in those days, but I guess these days they'd probably say bipolar. And he was suicidal very frequently. And there was one time when he failed to do the job properly, but he'd actually parked his car in our garage, you know, and he'd done the whole thing with the exhaust and he'd locked the door. And my mother just had this kind of premonition thing. She was working and she never used to go home for lunch. but she just felt she had to go home, and she went home and she found my dad unconscious. She arrived at the house and there was like blue smoke coming out of the garage, and she found him unconscious. And I remember, I kind of obviously felt very sad, but I felt angry as well. And then we went to the hospital, and my dad was just sitting up saying, "Oh, you know, I went on a big drive around, you know, all my favourite places, and then, you know, I just thought, I guess that must feel like a big rejection. I mean, if I was going to sort of psychoanalyze myself, I guess people would say, well, you know, your father was trying to sort of leave you. Maybe I took it like that. I don't know. It didn't. I think what I've always been very good at is creating my own little world. And I did that from early childhood. That's why I say I had a happy childhood. I have really happy memories. Me and my brother had a good time. Our parents were doing their own thing. My dad had his ups and downs, but he had a lot of ups as well. So, you know, those are just a few incidences. But I've told you that because you mentioned about this, you know, the need for attention, or I would say rather more than attention, what's the word I'll be looking for? Love might be the wrong word.
Confirmation, maybe.
Acceptance, and just to be needed, you know, to not be sort of rejected. I don't know.
I'll tell you why the reason I asked that, because I don't want to sort of, you know, stress you on a point there, but
no, it's fine. It's absolutely fine.
My father never had anything to do with me because he didn't want a third child, and my mother was pregnant with a third child. I never got any, I say any love, it's not true, I'm sure he loved me, but I didn't really feel that from my father. And I think I ended up being a presenter on MTV to get love from the world that doesn't really exist. And so it's like a, what's it called? It's like trying to fulfill one of the lack that you have with something else. And that is the drive that pushes you.
I think you have a very valid point. It's a very good point. And, you know, I tend to overthink a lot of things. I do spend a lot of time thinking, and sort of I come to all kinds of conclusions. But, you know, with age comes wisdom. And I mean, I know I'm very lucky to have a very positive outlook, which my brother wasn't lucky to have in that sense either. He was very up and down, bless him. He was incredibly talented. I mean, I can't wait for people to see all the pictures that he took. They're phenomenal and really something special. But he had problems in other ways, bless him. So I think with age comes wisdom, with experience comes wisdom. And, you know, I've sort of rationalized a lot of the stuff that I've been through, and recently as well. You know, my husband died 6 years ago. My brother was killed in a car crash 2 years before that. There's a lot of shit, but it's life. You know, it happens. There's people much worse off than me, you know, but it's how you deal with it. It's what affects your day-to-day life. And I think, luckily for me, touch wood, having a positive kind of streak, but also being able to sort of, you know, realize that you kind of got a choice. Well, I feel I have a choice. I can either sink or swim. And, you know, I try to keep things in the moment. I try and not project too much over future outcomes, you know, just be in the moment. And obviously, as I'm getting older and time is going faster, you know, you don't want to wish time away. You want to. And bottom line is, I suppose it's like a Buddhist thing or something. You know, it is as it is. Things happen and they are as they are. And you either deal with them or you don't. And I do have a lot of good stuff in life. I really value my friendships with people. I live by the beach now, which is amazing. I've got a great son. He's a brilliant drummer. My mum, bless her, is still around. She's 92. She lives a couple of miles away from me, and hopefully she's going to move quite close, even just a couple of doors down, which would be really nice. So yeah, there's a lot of positive things.
The United States Border Patrol has exciting and rewarding career opportunities with the nation's largest law enforcement organization. Border Patrol agents enjoy great pay, outstanding federal benefits, and up to $20,000 in recruitment incentives for newly appointed agents. If you are looking for a way to serve something greater than yourself, consider the United States Border Patrol. Learn more online at cbp.gov/careers/USBP. That's cbp.gov/careers/USBP.
When you save on auto insurance for driving safe with USAA Safe Pilot, you'll feel like a big deal. Even in a traffic jam. Save up to 30% with USAA Safe Pilot. Restrictions apply.
Let me take you back to then, you know, this really positive time as well, when things really did pick up, you know, when the second single come out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Soul Train from Swansea. And you you were in New York, weren't you, as well, recording. Can you tell me about that period?
Oh, my God, it's amazing. It's like a great time. The first time we went, because we went to work with Mike Thorne, who, you know, did Soft Cell and Carmel and Bronski Beat and everything. And we wanted to set the Chelsea Hotel. And the Chelsea Hotel was like fabulously dumpy in those days. It hadn't been refurbed, and that's how we wanted it. You know, there's some guy in the next room practicing saxophone, and because he was living there, the pillows stank. Rob actually had to have his room fumigated because he woke up the next morning with orange juice was full of cockroaches, and we just loved it. You know, we couldn't stop taking photographs of ourselves and being in there. And we drank our first tequila there, I think, which is amazing. And we got you know, we were A-listed for all the clubs, and like Grace Jones was hanging out with Dolph Lundgren, and there it was, all the concept clubs like Area and Limelight and everything, and Pyramid Club. Oh yes, I forgot to mention we were working as well. we were recording music. Mike Thorne was fun to work with. He got in Uptown Horns. They were a great horn section. Yeah, it was just a buzz all around. I mean, you know, any excuse. We were flown over. I guess it would have been business class or first class, and there were these like kids from Brum dressed in rag market clothes, and you know, my fake white fur coat, and of course it was fake because I wouldn't have wanted to wear real fur, but you know, looking down at my shoes, they're actually gaffer taped together. But we looked the business. So yeah, I mean, it was a really, really, really fab time, and I'm very grateful that
you recorded at Electric Lady Studios, didn't you? Which
certainly did.
Which was set up for Jimi Hendrix, actually.
Yeah.
He wanted certain specific things in a studio. And then you had all these amazing people who had recorded there, including you know, Stevie Wonder had been there.
Amazing. So, I know. It's just incredible. We were so lucky. And it was just a really good experience. And we went back a few times, actually, and we didn't go in the Chelsea Hotel again. I can't remember where we stayed, Milford Plaza or something. And it was like a family hotel, and they always used to make me show my passport when we came in. I don't know if they thought I was a woman of ill repute or something, because I was be wearing, like, you know, leopard skin and fishnet tights, and sort of, you know, not too far from 42nd Street. They probably thought, oh, should we let her in the hotel? I don't know. But yeah, no, it was good. It was good. Good, great time to be in New York, mid-80s. Yeah, good.
And you mentioned being on tour with Duran Duran and around the time of Planet Earth.
Yeah.
Now, I just wondered what that tour was like and what your impression. I know that you knew them, but they were young and a bit green, presumably back then. And also, when you see a band, you're never sure about their longevity. You're never sure about where they're really going to go in the world and what they're really going to do. And they've been one of the bands that
oh my God, I know,
have surprised everyone with a massive longevity.
Yeah.
And been creative throughout their careers. How did you view them back then? What were they
like? I'll tell you a funny story, and I'll try not to mention any names because it wouldn't be fair on the person that said it. But there was a very cool dude in Birmingham who was also in bands, you know, who did quite well. And it was a long time ago, but, you know, we would all record our demos and stuff at Bob Lamb's studio. Bob was the guy that produced the first UB40 album. It, you know, it was just a very basic one. I don't know if I'm now referring to the demo of Planet Earth, or I don't know if I'm referring to the finished version, but we were having one of our normal sort of regular late night gatherings around this person's house. I won't say who it was. He was a musician. He's a he. And he bought in, I don't know how he got it, but it was an early copy before it was released of Planet Earth. And he said, hey, guys, what do you reckon to this? And we all listened. We're all sort of like, hmm. And he goes, it's not very good, is it? It's not going to do anything. And he goes, shit, isn't it? Well, he was wrong.
This was a period where, you know, the second single, Soul Train, was successful. And that came along. How did your life change at that moment? Do you remember a change?
And that, of course, was produced by John Walters, who used to be in Landscape. A change. Well, we did Top of the Pops and everything. I think we were so sort of... We were proud of our Birmingham roots, and we were proud of our individuality, and we liked to think that we weren't sort of lumped in with anyone else. I know there were a lot of bands that were called sort of new jazz at the time, like Sade and Carmel and Blue Rondo a la Turk and various people, but we weren't really like them, actually. I think we're quite hard to bag, you know, with what we've done at Swan's Way. How did we feel? How did it change us? It really didn't change us at all. In fact, I remember, because, you know, we used to get put up in really nice hotels. The record company spent a lot of money on us. I think Simon Le Bon used to, not Simon Le Bon, Simon Woods used to pay us £50 a week.
That was a fortune back then. Because of the pull of fame and success and doing what you want to do, you can be extremely naive in terms of contractual things, in terms of what you deserve to have. Whereas when you get older, you have a completely different view of your worth.
Yeah.
Were you like that, do you think? Do you think you had this sort of essential naivety back then? Maybe everyone.
I think when it came to sort of business and contractual stuff, you know, we did get to use the top lawyers and stuff for the publishing contracts and the recording contracts. But I think we're just so giddy, you know, having fun and giggling, and, you know, we were probably very naive, actually. And probably should have done things differently, but we didn't. And we really had a lot of fun. And as I say, that we just concerned ourselves with all the normal stuff that we always concerned ourselves with. I remember there's a party thrown after we'd done, I think it was Astoria, Swan's Way, and there's a big party thrown at, I think, at the Gore Hotel in Kensington. And the really lovely guy used to be the editor of Melody Maker. What was his name? Steve Sutherland. He was so nice. He'd done a feature on us when we were in Brighton one time and put us on the front cover. And he was talking. I mean, we all had a lot to drink. And he just found it amazing that all I could talk about was my new fence I was getting in the garden. I think it's just like, I don't know, maybe a Birmingham thing. We're just kind of, oh, fame, whatever, you know, come on, let's just be pleased about the new fence.
This is a period of success. And I suppose, I mean, there are always many factors why a band splits or disintegrates or things change. What was the reason behind you as a band at that point changing? Because obviously you and Rick stayed together.
Yeah, we did.
But Robert went off to do his own thing. But
yeah, he certainly did. He did a thing called Mighty Math. He's so creative, Rob. He always does great stuff. He's an amazing artist now. I mean, just absolutely brilliant. Digital, spiritual photography. It's just gorgeous. Always excited, always wanting to do new things, always kind of hungry for experiences, hungry to create more. I was passionate about being creative. And the whole thing with Swan's Way sort of, you know, that slowed down. We'd done our album. You know, we had a good degree of success. But then I think, I don't know, it just seemed to be dragging. And me and Rick started getting passionate and excited about doing something completely different, you know?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So it sort of just petered out. This all happened actually with hindsight. Looking back, it all happened in quite a short space of time. But, you know, when you're young, that's something else I'm realising. Time has a completely different meaning. You know, 1 year when you're young is like a really long time, where it's like 1 year now, it's like, oh, where did that go? You know, and you're putting things in the diary for like next autumn or next winter, not this year, but 24. And it's like, it's a whole concept. You know, you have to adjust your reality. I have to adjust my reality completely about living on the planet at this point. But it just was kind of a natural progression how it fell apart, and very amicable. Nobody was upset with anyone, and me and Rick just decided, let's start from scratch again, let's do something completely different. And I've been doing backing vocals in Swan's Way, and then, you know, on some of the songs like Illuminations, singing with Rob on choruses. But I wanted to kind of really find my voice as well. I wanted to hone it down and be creative in a different way to how I have been creative in Swan's Way. So me and Rick decided to do something completely different. He went back to his guitar.
What sort of music do you think you were influenced at that point, that you actually decided to go in a slightly different direction?
We were listening very much to Nile Rodgers and Bernard Edwards for the grooves. We were listening to Grace Jones a lot. Sister Sledge, believe it or not. I hate to say it, but we'd always been fans of Gary Glitter. T-Rex, obviously, always loved Bowie and Roxy. So it was the glammy stuff, you know, the trashy glammy stuff with grooves. So we were kind of coming up. That's like, you know, the guitar riff, down now in No Memory. It's quite reminiscent of, say, like Stone Satisfaction, or, you know, a T-Rex riff or something. That was important for us. But also I had to find a vocal style that I really liked. So I think I tried mixing a bit of probably like Grace Jones, you know, obviously primarily myself, but I took influences from different people. So I think that, who else are we listening to, I'm wondering? I think that's about it in a nutshell, really. That was it. Yeah, and we bought a very early like little four track setup, so we could do stuff at home ourselves, which was perfect. That was new. Everything was, you know, you couldn't really do that in Swan's Way. But a couple of years later, there were these home recording setups, and Rick learned to program, and he ended up being very good at that, actually. So that's how we started.
So was this a point for you to really get into writing as well, much more? Did that push you in that way, just purely because, you know, you had the equipment?
Well, I mean, a lot of the Swan's Way stuff, actually, you know, quite a lot of the lyrics I'd written as well with Rob. I'd played keyboards before when I was in Playthings, but I mean, Rick was really good with the guitar and the chords and everything, although I put, you know, chords together as well for songs, but the lyrics were really mine and the vocal melodies. We worked very well together, and I actually found the voice I wanted to use. I found it for No Memory demo. That was a breakthrough for me. That was, what do they call it? One of those moments.
light bulb.
Yeah, something like that. I remember actually I'd gone to the little Indian shop at the bottom of my road to buy a pint of milk. And I was going to come and sing after that. I was going to come and sing the main vocal on No Memory. And I was quite nervous thinking, how's this going to sound? And I went and did it. And I always remember that. And it sounded good. And we started playing it to people and they're like, wow, this is really good. So that really inspired us. We did three songs, first of all. I think there's Rhythm of Resistance, No Memory, and Plug Me In. So,
was this when The Tube, the British TV programme, got interested in yeah. you and coming yeah. to do a little small
yes, film thing? No, we, yeah, we went to Newcastle. I love that piece of film footage. That's one of my favourite, actually. How it happened was because we'd obviously had some success with Swan's Way. So, you know, I was in a position where I could actually pick up the telephone and phone up people, producers at Radio One, and they would actually, you know, the secretaries would put me through. And so I sent that early demo. It might have been to Mike Hawkes, I seem to think, at the time, possibly. And he absolutely loved it. So Radio One session was the first thing we got. That was the first sort of Scarlet Fantastic breakthrough. We got a phone call from Jazz Summers as well at that point. He'd liked it. The Tube got in touch.
Jazz Summers, of course, Wham.
Yeah,
with Sada Napier Bell.
Yeah,
and
bless,
also,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, got the late Jazz Summers. Yeah.
Just to say who he is. That's a
point. Yeah, of course, absolutely. Then, oops, we went up to Newcastle. And they said that the guy who'd made Elvis Costello videos was going to make our video. And they said, have you got any ideas? And I just had this idea. I just said, yeah, I want to be surrounded by like large mirrors. And I want it to be kind of a bit psychedelic and moody. And he just got this whole idea. He just clicked. And he had some other ideas about going out in the hills outside of Newcastle. And he got me to wear this skirt that was like a screen so he could project stuff on it. So he projected a picture of Rick playing the guitar onto my skirt. And it was quite an artsy idea. And it just came together beautifully. And I mean, we didn't see it before it was released. And I remember, you know, you're thinking, oh my God, what's it going to look like on the telly? You know, ah. And oh my God, I saw it and I was like, oh God, oh. And then my friend started phoning me up and it's like, you look great, it's fantastic, I love it, you know. And so that was really good. That got quite a buzz going for Scarlet Fantastic. But I have to tell you, you know, I said earlier on in the interview about one of the worst moments ever, about you really think you've blown it. Okay, so we did this video for The Tube, which was on, you know, which is still on YouTube now. It's brilliant, it's one of my favourite. And we did it to the demo before we recorded the finished version at Pete Waterman's studio. That's another story. But so we obviously had got a buzz going about this because it was a really good little piece of film. So we were going to do some gigs and we were going to do this secret warm-up gig at a college in London. And we said to them, do not advertise it. You know, this is like a secret gig. And also, I don't know what me and Rick were thinking, but we had with us as a backing band, like, and they were very good, but they were like a reggae band from Handsworth with a keyboard player and a bass player. And I don't know. And so this place was really, really hot. I was wearing this white satin catsuit with very high heels and the ceiling was really, really low. So sort of like that. And then I got really sweaty and the catsuit became kind of like clingy and sticky. And then the sound was absolutely diabolical. And they bloody well did advertise it. And so all the record companies turned up. And it's like, I could see as this is all going horrifically wrong, I could see each one leaving until there was like, you know, virtually no one in the room. And oh my God, I was so disappointed. And we played a really bad gig. We were dreadful, you know. I remember we had a manager at the time called Jack Stephen. He was lovely. He lived in Chiswick. We stayed with him and I remember I just went to bed and I pulled the duvet over my head and cried my eyes out. And we did have to work about a year to get back kind of what we'd lost, because everybody just thought, oh God, they're shit, you know, they made a great film, but they're just rubbish, you know. But actually, we pulled it all together in the end. And where there's a will, there's a way.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, we talk about failing and falling. I mean, I did my massive, great big fail in public in front of a load of people. You feel it's the most awful thing doing it on stage in front of people. You're so vulnerable. But yeah, I picked myself back up.
A lot of people that you work with, you seem to crop up again in your life. You mentioned about recording, going to PWL. And working with Pete Waterman, who you work mm-hmm. with later. You mentioned John Walters from Landscape.
Yeah.
Einstein A Go-Go, brilliant song. And
And
working with him, and then working with him many, many years later with the second Scarlet Fantastic album. But before we get to that, let's go to PWL and your introduction to that. And this, what was then just going into that period where it became the biggest music factory, wasn't it? It was just the most amazing, successful production unit in that era.
Yeah, they were. And they did incredibly well. It wasn't the kind of production that would have suited Scarlet Fantastic. So when we got involved with Pete, we said we want to kind of produce it ourselves, but we'd like to use, you know, your engineers here. So there was Rick, myself, a guy called Dave Washburn, and a girl called Karen Hewitt. And we did it on the night shift. What had happened? Our manager at the time, Jack Stephen, who's a lovely guy, he used to be an A&R at, I think it was Sony. And we'd gone and played him a Scarlet Fantastic demo, and he absolutely loved it and said, I'd like to manage you. So the initial introduction to Pete Waterman came through Jack. And so Pete had no memory. I don't think he was convinced by it, but he said, look, I'll give you kids the studio time. You know, he's a larger than life character as Pete Waterman. He'd be there in his cowboy boots on his throne with his missiles in his office. So he gave us this downtime in the studio to go and record No Memory. And we did. We had great fun doing it. Happy, happy time. And after that, he absolutely loved it. He said, it's a dog's bollocks. So, you know, he absolutely loved it. And because he was kind of behind it and they were so happening as a, you know, PWL, everyone wanted to be involved with them. So he set up a couple of record company meetings, and we were very lucky. We were wined and dined, and we were given a choice of a couple of labels that we could sign to, and we chose Arista. We really liked Jeff at the time, who was he was the managing director at the time. So yeah, that was a good time, and then we carried on to record the rest of the album at PWL, and so it was produced by Rick and Dave Washburn and myself and Karen did some of the mixes that still carry on, you know, that people still play. Someone said at Carcassonne last year that No Memory, the extrasensory mix, I said, was the biggest record there. And in fact, some guys are actually doing another remix of it. It seems to go on, and it's great. I mean, yeah, it's good, no complaints.
I mean, did that really, I mean, in the early 90s, I think it was when it really kicked in, wasn't it? As the club hit.
Yeah, it became quite a big thing in Ibiza and, you know, the Balearic scene, and also in the clubs in England, especially in Liverpool. And because Andy Weatherall had picked up on it, you see. Andy Weatherall had discovered this little gem, No Memory. And I think it became the hedonistic song for everyone. You know, we have the sun in our hair, moon in our eyes, and we just don't give a damn because we're free. Everybody loved that and still does, you know. And at my very best, that's what I like to believe that I can be, you know, free, because it's we have a lot of crap in our heads, and you know, we just don't give a damn because we're free. The sun in our hair, moon in our eyes, that's nature helping us to feel free. It's getting out of the head into a bigger thought process to do with the universe. And yeah, I'm going hippie on you now, by the way.
Okay.
But that's and I'm so happy that feeling that I had for that song has what's the word? It's transmitted. It's been caught by people. People have made it kind of their song as well. You know, it's helped them through hard times. A lot of people have told me that, which is that's the best thing ever. If just having done that once in your life, it makes it all worthwhile. So
well, that's fantastic. That's really a really nice thought and a really nice thing to have achieved, I think.
Yeah, I'm very proud. Now,
about Leif, because was this around the time that you met him?
Leif?
Yeah.
Leafy Tree. He's my cowboy guardian angel now. I just wrote a song actually called Cowboy Guardian Angel. I've just recorded it for my new album, which will be out next year. Leafy Tree, bless him. He was from Virginia. I met him in a bar in Dublin. I was actually living with someone else at the time, an Irish guy. Bless him. No, he was lovely as well. But Leif walked into the bar. He got his cowboy boots on, spurs, cowboy hat. I think I'd always had a bit of a dream about meeting a cowboy. So, and he seemed to be the real deal. He got this drawl. I remember one of my girlfriends, a couple of weeks later, when we scarpered and went to Birmingham for a little bit, she goes, going into a hotel room with him must be like going into a hotel room with Elvis. So, yeah, I met him supposedly to write songs with, which of course is what we ended up doing, but of course a passion sort of developed quite quickly. We were very young, very very young still, and yeah, so we went via London, via Birmingham, and then booked a flight to Turkey and sort of said our spiritual vows, and we're married for 27 years. It's a long time, isn't it?
When did you know that he was the one?
Instinct, intuition. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I've been like that a lot in my life, and I think I still continue to be. So I'm hopefully I've got a good radar. Well, I did in that case. I mean, it wasn't always easy. Of course it wasn't. Nothing ever is, you know. Love isn't easy. But I felt that he was meant to be a part of my life. And I'd also had these really sort of interesting dreams and sort of stirrings before I met him. And one of the dreams was this big, I saw this big canvas with a blue background and this big eagle on it. And when I met him as well, he had like an eagle on his jacket. So I was thinking this is like a sign, but also like the American thing as well. Yeah, I don't know. We just kind of knew, you know, you throw yourself into a situation, and basically we ran off together. Well, he, I think, had a partner in, or still possibly did, in San Francisco. And I thought I was in love with this person in Dublin. And, you know, I'd got my house full of stuff there. I'd got my piano there, all my plants and everything that I'd had for years when I was living with Rick. And so just scarpered. And my mother actually said at that point, she asked one of my friends, she goes, is she mad? Has she gone mad? And in the end, obviously, it all worked out, and my mum ended up being very fond of Leif. And he struggled with his health throughout the whole relationship. He struggled. But in 96, he was given the gift of life. He had a liver transplant. And then, you know, he lived for 21 years after that, which is quite amazing. And then we had a son in 2000, who's now a big lad, 23, drummer, brilliant drummer. I probably mentioned that earlier. Sean Vincent. So I don't know, it's kind of, you just think somehow, I sometimes think that we have this sort of destiny trail that we're on. I've kind of, and that you have to sort of be open for things to work out the way they're supposed to. And sometimes the only way you can know how is intuition. You have to trust it sometimes. And that's kind of what I do. So, and I still do.
But you worked together, maybe. You worked together, wrote songs, and you had a deal with them.
Pete, yeah, well, what happened was this, because I met Leif in 90, we very quickly recorded an album, we wrote a load of songs together, very creative relationship, we wrote a load of songs together, we rented this little cottage out in Shropshire, which is gorgeous, surrounded by sheep, and we used to drive into Birmingham every day and go and record it with Bob Lamb, so we did an album called Pilots of the Impossible. And then it was at this point, end of 91, early 92, Now Memory was getting really popular. You know, people were telling me, oh, it's selling, you know, original copies are selling for like hundreds of pounds and, you know, blah, blah. And so this is all good news. And so I was just in my little country cottage. I wasn't really aware of what was going on. And so I thought, oh, because we needed a record deal. We needed, you know, we'd done this album. So I thought I'll phone up Pete Waterman. So I phoned up Pete Waterman. He was like, yes. He goes, come in, have a meeting, you know. And bless him. I was later told by an American manager I had, interesting story. Pete said at a later point, oh, he'd got us a secret detective out looking for me, which I thought was interesting. But my manager, Bud Prager, at the time, he used to manage Foreigner, the late Bud Prager, but bless him. So that's what Bud told me a few years later. But anyway, so...
Wait. What was he looking for with the secret detective?
He was looking for me to find out where I'd gone, apparently.
Oh, right.
So apparently, this is the story. As, you know, who knows? I mean, he told Bud later that he had been looking for me or had a secret detective out looking for me. Unless I've got it wrong, but I seem to remember that story. Okay, back to what I was saying. So we went in to see Pete, me and Leif, and we played Pete a demo of three songs that we'd done. And Pete just goes, you know how good these are, don't you? Of course, we were loving all of this. And we went, yeah. He goes, well, you know, don't you? I said, well, yeah, we know. He goes, I bet a lot of people don't see it, do they? And we're going like, he goes, so what do you want to do? And I said, well, we'd like to come in and, you know, record a single. He goes, come in and do this, you know. And he sort of opened his arms wide, you know, come in and do what you like, you know. We're like, wow, you know, this is really good news. So we moved to London and we signed a publishing deal with All Boys Music for our Kale and Kale stuff because... it's spelled K-A-H-A-L, that's my married name, Cahal, pronounced Kale. Well, Leif said it was, but I always say Cahal, but anyway, whatever. We signed a deal and we worked with a brilliant guy who's a very dear friend of mine called Barry Stone from Jules and Stone, and he's produced so many people over the years. He's become quite a successful producer. So we worked with him, recorded loads and loads of songs. We were actually with Pete for about 3 years. And he sent us up to a studio in Manchester and he goes, go and hang out with Oasis. I think he was trying to find this sort of perfect sound for us. I don't know. He was going through an interesting period at the time. He'd signed Dead or Alive as well. And I think everyone was getting a bit frustrated because, you know, he'd apparently got, you know, these bands signed and he didn't seem to be doing an awful lot. He was kind of involved. I mean, I love Pete and I would never say anything negative about him, so I'm not. He was a great guy to work with, very creative and funny. And he had said originally, you know, he saw a gap in the market for me and Leif as like the new Eurythmics, this, that and the other. And we had a really good record deal, actually. Financially, it was amazing. And we did a lot of travelling as well as recording. And more recently, the songs are actually available as a little compilation on, you know, you can download Show Me No Mercy, it's called, which was the song which everyone seemed to, that was the more PWL type song because we co-wrote it with Mike Stock. It's called Show Me No Mercy. It's a catchy pop song. It's good. It's there online if anyone wants to download it. And that's a Kale and Kale. I've called it Scarlet Fantastic as well because then people will kind of know, you know, who it is and where it is and whatever. So, yeah, me and Leif, we wrote loads of songs. And then after that, we went through various scenarios and then we did an album. Well, we had Sean, you know, in 2000. Oh, and we ran a nightclub in Notting Hill.
I know, this is mad. Absolutely mad. So, how do you get to run a nightclub?
Well, Leif was a country rocker originally, but, you know, back in the States, he used to support his music by bartending and he was like a brilliant bartender. So he managed a couple of bars on the Portobello Road. There was the ground floor bar and then there was the other one. I can't remember what it was called, but I used to put on Maggie's music nights. So I would sort of source local talent. I ran this little ad, I think, in NME or something, and I used to say, oh, send us your demo and... I found some really good talents, actually, some great people. gosh, I'm just trying to, off the top of my head, I can't remember the, but a couple of acts that have gone on to do quite well.
Richard Norris from The Grid, you had the Chemical Brothers, didn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. The Chemical Brothers did a party there. I mean, but so what happened was, because we got quite a little bit notorious around Notting Hill, an opportunity came for us to invest in, with a Swedish guy and some Moroccan guys, in this sort of underground club type place. So, yeah, so we put music on and had bands and had parties. I don't think the legalities were all in place. I think we had a music license for like a duo, but you know, we'd have four bands on and everything. It was all a bit naughty of us, really, but what the heck, we did it. And then actually, that was baby time as well. I think I remember, because smoking was legal in those days, you could smoke in places. And I remember I had this little sort of, I used to call it my bubble, that I pushed Sean around in when he was a baby, because I'd take him down to all the sound checks. So he grew up with thumping bass going through his little baby body. And there'd be like this plastic cover you could put on with the air conditioning in the little baby buggy. So I wouldn't feel bad if people were smoking down there a bit, but I'd only have him there for the sound checks. I'd make sure that he'd go home with a nice Swedish waitress babysitter.
I want to get back to Scarlet Fantastic, because when I mentioned John Waters,
yeah,
then again in 2016, you released the second album.
Back to Leaf again. We did, the first album we did was Mighty K Club Silencio, and we did a collaboration with Krabby from Pop Will Eat Itself. And then what was the next one? Oh, and then I did a Maggie and Martin album with Martin Watkins, who was the keyboard player for, I'm going in chronological order here, he was the keyboard player for Mark Holman, and still is. And we did a lovely album. I'm very proud of it. It's called Union. In the meantime, Leaf did an album. He wanted to do his more country stuff, which it's a great little album. Me and Leaf together in 2016, recorded, and it was very therapeutic for him, because he was very unwell. And I'd say from about 2015 and 2016, focusing on making an album, the music, you know, the distraction of focusing on that and not focusing on his health issues, it was really good. It was very therapeutic. And it wasn't John Walters that was involved with that one. It was one of the songs on it was a co-write with Mike Thorne, from the producer in New York. I'd been in New York in 2014, and I'd visited him, stayed with him, and we'd written together a song called Beyond Pluto. And me and Leaf recorded it and put it on the Reverie album, which is the one that was released, I think, 2016. The album I'm recording now is kind of a natural progression from the Reverie album. And one of the songs so far is a co-write with John Walters, because we did get together and we wrote a few songs together. And one of them, a tango, it's called Berlin Room, is a co-write with John. And I might put another one or two on, I'm not quite sure yet. I've done about seven, waiting for three of them to be mixed, and then I've got about another two or three to do, so it'll be done next year. So yeah, and it's nice to go back and work with people that you had worked with in the 80s. I did that both with John Walters and Mike Thorne.
So I think what's interesting is that you can hear, especially with Reverie, you can hear development, but at the same time you can hear the history. Do you see what I mean? It's like, it feels, yes, like a mixture, which is very clever, and it feels like you haven't stuck in the past. You've actually, you hear the development, what I'm trying to say.
Thank you. I always thought it's important to, you know, move on, to try and create something new. I wouldn't just want to regurgitate what I've done in the past. I mean, I think it's great that people, you know, reinvent songs like No Memory, you know, remixes and stuff. That's absolutely brilliant. They're putting their own take on it. And obviously I've done sort of acoustic versions and stuff, because people just like that song. But in terms of style, I wouldn't try and purposely, it just wouldn't make sense to me to go back. Interesting. I mean, I'm watching the, I don't know if you saw it, it's great, it's on iPlayer at the moment, the Picasso documentary, Beauty and the Beast. He comes out with some really interesting things. And he's always doing something new. He's always creating something new, always wants to move forward. I think what I do is probably, it's probably a mishmash of everything I've ever done with maybe just some things of the moment thrown in. Like I work with some brilliant local musicians and also this fantastic young engineer who I met. I was doing like a guest lecture at Brighton Uni for the production music students. And I met this guy, Sean Horsfield, and he's engineering all my stuff. It's really good because Leaf, you see, used to do all of that. And of course, Leafy's not here anymore. So I had to find someone else. And Sean Horsfield is absolutely brilliant. And as I said, I've got all kinds of people playing. I've got my lovely dentist on trumpet. I've got my piano tuner playing the piano. He's brilliant. He plays in bands as well. And my dentist is in jazz bands and stuff as well. So it's, as I said, I think it's kind of a natural carry on from the Reverie album. It's going to be another Scarlet Fantastic album. But again, it's something different as well. Different because I've co-written some of this stuff with John Walters. And of course, Hi-Fi Sean's been mixing the tracks for me as well. And he's so talented and so creative. And he adds some lovely bits as well. So, yeah, it's great.
I want to ask you something at the end because, and I hope it's not too personal, but when my mum died, I looked after my mum for many years.
Oh, bless
you. And the last 3 years, I stayed with her in England. Mm. And in the last 2 weeks, got a hospital bed in the front room and slept next to her. Oh, and, you know, like you do everything.
Wonderful.
And accompanied her right to the end. But the night before she died, in fact, it was two nights before she died, but she went unconscious. Mm-hmm. She said to me what she wanted for my life.
Oh, wow. And
she said, I want you to meet a man who is as kind to you as you have been to me. And then she looked at my life from the future and said, this is how I see your life going.
How wonderful. Basically
gave me this sort of, it's like a sort of a self-help library of books that is here.
That's sick.
In my memory. And it left me with this amazing positive thing that I hold with me in my life. And when things go wrong, I always depend on it and look at it. And I just wonder, because you had, which was clearly, I think you said 27 years, you had a very long, loving relationship with your husband, Leaf.
He wasn't always easy. Don't forget, he was a cowboy.
But what I just wondered he's left you with that is like a positive thing in your life.
I do feel, touch wood, that there is someone looking over me. I mean, that's why I wrote Cowboy Guardian Angel. Before he died, and we knew it was coming because he'd had kidney transplant, bless him, as well in the end. And it was all going really well. And then suddenly his liver packed up, which is just very unfortunate. So he kind of went downhill and downhill and downhill. But because we knew it was coming, which was a blessing that we knew, it meant we could kind of clean the slate with each other. We could forgive each other for some of the awful things we might have done to each other or some of the bad patterns we'd fallen into. You know, when you're with someone 27 years, it's a long time. And, you know, we went through a lot. And so we made peace. So, you know, he could go on. I could be peaceful in the knowledge that he's gone on to, you know, the greater energy, which we're all going there one day. I mean, you know, but I felt a sense of peace, and you know, we achieved what we'd set out to do, and I felt also that he wanted for me as well to, you know, carry on in my life doing music and, you know, maybe meet someone else, which funnily enough I have. And funnily enough, he's American as well. It's just such a, I sometimes think, oh, Leafy Tree, what have you, who, you set me up, haven't you? The guy that I'm with now is the loveliest man, very kind and caring and very he loves my music. He loves music, and we've seen so many great gigs recently. We saw Peaches at the weekend. We saw Grace Jones. Saw Depeche Mode. Lovely man. And he's also a widow, and I feel that kind of, I don't know, that maybe there are people looking out for us, people up there.
Oh, that's wonderful. I mean, we did talk earlier, and I'll just say this as a final comment. You talked earlier about what success is, and I've always felt success is actually doing and almost the allowance of being able to carry on and do what you want to do, which you've always done and which you are doing now.
Yeah.
And I wish you much success with the next Scarlet Fantastic album.
Thank you so much.
Everything they say about you is true.
Your check's in the post.
You're a lovely person. Maggie, oh, bless you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You're lovely too.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews. And here is where you can connect.
When you save on auto insurance for driving safe with USAA Safe Pilot, you'll feel like a big deal. Even in a traffic jam. Save up to 30% with USAA Safe Pilot. Restrictions apply.